I'm now going to rewind and go back to Mao versus State. We haven't seen the person yet.
She is here.
She is here. Okay. All right. Yeah, absolutely. Go get her. Thank you for your patience.
No problem.
These things happen. Is it Ms. Miller?
Yes, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to the Court of Appeals to both Ms. Miller and Mr. Zettler. My name is John Rodenberg. I'm presiding this morning. With me are Judges Smith and Sleater. We're going to rewind and go back to Mao versus State. There was some confusion about scheduling, and it doesn't make any difference right now because everyone's here and ready to go, and we filled in with cases 2 and 3 while you're waiting, and Mr. Zettler was very patient and listened to those two arguments, so we're going to go back to Mao. Are you ready to go, Ms. Miller?
Ready, I'm going to be here now.
Okay. You'll have 15 minutes each for your principal argument. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you wish to use that time. Give us your name when you start your comments and the party you represent so that we've got that for the recording. And I think the last person at the podium might have been a bit taller than you, so there's a little toggle switch down and to your right beneath the podium.
Oh.
If you want to use it, I'm not directing you to lower it, but it seemed like it might be a little too high for you. Whenever you're ready.
May it please the court, my name is Maria Miller. I am here representing the appellant in this case, Bernarth Mao. We are here today asking for this court to reverse the decision of the district court. The district court ruled in Mr. Mao's case that he had failed to meet an exception to the two-year filing deadline in a post-conviction motion. We believe that Mr. Mao did meet the exception to the two-year requirement. It's undisputed that the petition was filed outside of the 2 years, but we do believe that he merits an exception to that.
More than 2 years from the date of the disposition of the case.
Correct, Your Honor. So the disposition occurred in 2013. Mr. Mao filed in 2018. It's undisputed that that's outside of the 2 years that would be required traditionally under the statute. However, the statute does contain an exception that allows the appellant, in this case Mr. Mao, to file after that 2 years if he believes that he's merited such an exception. The exception that he has brought in this case is in the interest of justice, which we believe that he has shown that he has met. Mr. Mao was given ineffective assistance of counsel by his attorney at his proceeding in 2013. Mr. Mao was not told that he would face certain deportation from the United States if he pled guilty to that offense.
Can I just clarify, Ms. Miller, does the record, is there evidence in the record that indeed, or is this just information your client found out afterwards, that offense for which he was convicted of was on the list of automatic deportations versus maybe? I don't know if it's relevant directly to your argument or the response to it, but you made that mention just now, and I was curious if...
So factually what happened, Your Honor, was that he pled guilty to this offense and then he was placed in deportation. He appeared before an immigration judge in 2018. The immigration judge said, you will be deported for this offense. You need to seek counsel. He then sought counsel regarding the immigration issue with my office. At that point, he was informed that his case would result in certain deportation. There is a court case from the Eighth Circuit. I will admit I don't have that site offhand, but I can get it, that does show that domestic assault is considered an aggravated felony and will result in certain deportation. So that fact is well established, that it will result in certain deportation.
So we'll presume for a moment then, based on what's in the record, that if your client was eligible to stand before the court in a post-conviction for ineffective assistance of counsel, would have a meritorious argument. My question is, though, that for you, is we've had a number of unpublished opinions pretty much factually on point to your client, and they're all unpublished because they're citing to Sanchez. now they're unpublished. So this would be your opportunity, if you're able to explain to us specifically what mistake we, our court has made in all of those, or what's specifically unique that you think in terms of either the petition being the petition or the basis, in other words, for the injustice being other than the basis for which there's ineffective assistance of counsel, such that the 2 years ought to start in 2018, for example.
Your Honor, the difference that I do believe exists in Mr. Mao's case is, one, the certainty of the deportation. So in the cases in Sanchez and in the unpublished decisions, there is language that cites to the plea petition which says may result in deportation. I do think the difference in Mr. Mao's case is that this is unequivocally would result in deportation, and unequivocally would result in deportation without the eligibility for relief to remain in the United States. So I think that that is one difference. I think that the second difference that I would argue is that the Eighth Circuit case that was released makes this unequivocal, and that Mr. Mao, the unequivocal nature of it became certain when that Eighth Circuit case was released, which was more recently, which was in 2018. This is not in my appellate brief, I will be quite frank. And so I'm
not. The circuit case is not cited in your brief?
It is not cited in my brief. And so that does put me in a little bit of a position, as I'm not sure how to argue that to this court, since I don't think that the...
Well, are you asking the court to grant you the opportunity to submit supplemental authorities after the argument?
I am asking for that, Your Honor.
I'll take that under advisement.
Okay. But I do, again, still think that Mr. Mao's case is different than these unpublished cases in the sense that his was unequivocal deportation. He was not told that by his counsel. Ineffective assistance of counsel, Mr. Mao had no way to know that his attorney was ineffective until he was placed in deportation. He had no way of knowing that he would be, that this was an issue in his case. If we were to say that ineffective assistance of counsel and that the claim doesn't arise because the person, the defendant in this hypothetical situation, doesn't know about, could have found out the immigration consequences prior to being placed in deportation, it wouldn't hold that these claims could ever be viable, because if a defendant in a criminal proceeding should be able to rely on their attorney's advice, and if that attorney says, this is not an issue for you, you are safe to plead guilty.
Did his attorney actually say that it's safe for you, or did his attorney just not give him advice?
His attorney supplied a letter that is in the record, Your Honor.
Seemed a little equivocal, though.
It does seem a little equivocal, and I do think that that is one issue why the district court should have granted at least an evidentiary hearing in this case to find more out about that. I do agree that it's a little vague, and I think that in this circumstance, obviously, it's difficult for an attorney to somewhat throw themselves under the bus and say that they've committed ineffective assistance of counsel and file a letter.
We see them. Sometimes they do. Sometimes defense counsel says, I blew this one, and I told them the wrong thing.
Right. And, I mean, I do think that that would have been an issue that should have at least been determined at a evidentiary hearing, in the very least, instead of just a straight denial by the district court. In regards to Your Honor's, the second part of Your Honor's question about how this is different, how the claim arose at the same time, or how the claim didn't arise at the same time, I would again make the same argument that he wasn't aware unequivocally that he would be deported up for this offense until, A, the Eighth Circuit case came out, and B, until he was placed in immigration proceedings and a judge told him such and our office told him such. So those are two different factual issues that he found out about after the fact. And again, if there's no way for him to know that that offense made him unequivocally deportable until someone gave him the correct information. I don't believe he had any way to find out, or until the Eighth Circuit made such a finding, that he would have had any way to determine whether or not it unequivocally made him deportable from the United States.
Can I just, so is it your position that that Eighth Circuit case was new enough that even under the objective standard, it's not evident that he knew or should have known that deportation was unequivocal?
Correct. Yes.
And so that's the distinction that you're making. So even under an objective standard, he would have gone to an immigration lawyer before entering the plea and got all the information that the law in place at that time was there's equivocal, which is consistent with the notice that it was in the plea petition, or the usual notice that it may have consequences. And that is the distinction you make factually, and you believe legally that's an important distinction as well.
I believe that's an important distinction, Your Honor, because up until that Eighth Circuit case came out, one could argue that it was somewhat uncertain. One could argue that there was no way to know for sure, that there were arguments to be made about why a domestic assault conviction was not an aggravated felony. So in immigration law, an aggravated felony has to meet the definition of what's called a crime of violence. A crime of violence is an art of law. I mean, it's something that requires that there be harm to the victim and that there be but there be harm, that there be actual harm. So a lot of immigration attorneys have in the past made the argument that domestic violence does in Minnesota does not meet that definition, because under the Minnesota domestic abuse statute, you can make a threat of harm. You don't have to actually physically harm someone. So there's been a lot of litigation over that issue. But the Eighth Circuit did, again, unequivocally say in a more recent decision that is unequivocally a crime of, is a defined, meets the definition of a crime of violence and therefore is an aggravated felony, which would therefore result in certain deportation.
But isn't, and this is where I think, I mean, dealing with Sanchez, when we're talking about ineffective assistance of counsel, the argument, the substantive argument is that under Padilla, at the time, before the Eighth Circuit decision, but in 2013, it was ineffective assistance of counsel to fail to advise him that he faced certain deportation, right? So I mean, that's the substantive argument. So now we're trying to get into, well, what prompted, you know, we're into the, well, the, you know, did you act within 2 years of reasonably finding out, and or what, whatever the, when he knew or should have known. And I'm having trouble putting together that it wasn't clear with the ineffective assistance of counsel's substantive claim, which is that it should have been known then. And then also trying to distinguish this from Sanchez, where, you know, the ineffective assistance of counsel claim and the deadline seem to be measured from the same point.
Yes, Your Honor. So again, it is somewhat difficult because we're not left with a very good factual record, because there was never an evidentiary hearing scheduled, so there's no testimony that was ever taken. There is a statement from my client in the record that says he does not believe his attorney told him anything about this. My client's obviously not here today, but he is, by talking to him, you would not know that he is an immigrant. He doesn't have an accent.
He's lived here since he was like 4 years old or something.
Right. So, and my client says that his attorney never asked him, that there was never a discussion about whether or not he could face immigration consequences, because there was never a discussion of whether he was an immigrant in the first place. This crime occurred prior to Padilla. It occurred prior to there being a lot of discussions, as there are now, about advisals. There is a general advisal in the plea petition that is in the record. But even before Padilla, the Minnesota rules said that the defendant needed to be advised of certain things, and immigration consequences were part of the Minnesota rule even before Padilla.
In the same way that they appear on the petition, that they're sort of there may be immigration.
Right, exactly.
Sort of general, yes. This could cause a problem if you're an immigrant.
Exactly. And so my client's position is that he was never told anything, that his attorney never asked him. There was never a conversation. My client never knew to tell the attorney that he was a permanent resident in the United States because he didn't know he needed to do that. And the attorney never asked him. Again, one can assume, as I'm doing right now, that may have been because he doesn't speak, that he doesn't have an accent, that there's no way of knowing that he was an immigrant.
If he speaks good English and he's been here, the petition was written in English, he's been here since he was 4 years old, he'd signed the petition, and the petition does say there may be consequences.
Well, so as the statement from my client says in the record, his attorney says that he never read the petition. So that would be a fault of his that he didn't read the petition. He relied on his attorney's advice and relied on his attorney asking him the questions that he thought he should need to know the answers to. These would be things that could be more fleshed out in an evidentiary hearing. So again, I understand the limitations of what we're dealing with. Then the attorney says that he doesn't recall exactly what happened, what advisals he gave, what advisals he didn't, and what conversations were had. And that is where part of the ineffective assistance of counsel claim comes from, is that that attorney fell below the standards of reasonableness by even so much as asking my client what was going on and if he needed to have these advisals. But then the other argument that I'm making is that there does, in 2018, when the Minnesota Court of Appeal, the Eighth Circuit, released this decision saying it's an aggravated felony, that also would be an exception to the rule when at that point my client would have known definitively or should have known definitively that this was a deportable offense. I believe my time is...
Give me additional questions.
No, it's clear up if there's any.
All right, you will have 5 minutes on rebuttal if you want to use that time.
Thank you.
Mr. Zettler.
May it please the court. My name is Todd Zettler. I represent respondent, the state of Minnesota. The question in this court is whether the post-conviction court clearly abused its discretion, and it didn't. The arguments being made here are essentially to reverse Sanchez and reverse all of this court's essentially unpublished opinions, which have followed Sanchez, and they followed Sanchez consistently. Not one has departed, and there's no reason to depart.
Well, the last portion of what you just said, I want to question just a little bit. If we rewind it all the way back to Sanchez and look at the facts in Sanchez, the district court actually told Mr. Sanchez on July 6th of 2004 that his appeal had not been filed. It appears that Mr. Sanchez then left for Mexico with that information and returned more than 3 years later. And it was in that context that the Supreme Court said, you knew then, it's the same thing now as it was then. I'm not so sure that we should keep stretching Sanchez to fit facts that are significantly different than those in that case.
So the question is, when does the case accrue, right, in that instance? I mean, Sanchez answers two questions, really. So first, let me back up one step. Under the post-conviction statute, is it timely or not? It's not.
It's not. We agree on that.
Okay. So then you're looking at the exceptions, and then you look at Sanchez. And Sanchez answers two questions as far as the exceptions go. Number one, the interest of justice exception, when does it apply? What is it looking at? Is it looking at the merits of the petition, or is it looking at why is it filed late? The answer from Sanchez, from our Supreme Court, is it's why is it late, not the substance of the petition. And so in this case, the district court followed Sanchez and said it doesn't apply because when the petition, the reason that they're alleging it's late is the same as the petition, the interest of justice exception doesn't apply. That's first. Second, even if you say it does, and this court's opinions follow Sanchez the same way, even if you say it does, it accrues. Then you look at when does it accrue. It accrues, according to our Supreme Court in Sanchez, when basically you know all the facts. And so Sanchez dealing with when did they know all the facts to bring their claim when their claim was ineffective assistance based upon an appeal issue.
Not taking the appeal.
Right. So the issue, though, and the accrual date has been consistently held to be when you objectively knew all the facts necessary for ineffective assistance of counsel, which in this case accrued on the same day that the actual plea was entered. So if that was ineffective assistance, they knew then. That's the date of accrual.
Yeah, I mean, so whether, if he'd had a second lawyer on the scene to analyze, you know, what did this, did that lawyer do it right, then he would have known that he had a potential ineffective assistance claim, but he happened not to have brought a second lawyer with him.
Which is a subjective, when did he subjective, no question, but not an objective. The Minnesota Supreme Court clearly and rejected the idea that this is unfair, that, and it followed Minnesota case law. When do we hold cases to accrue? And sometimes it is unfair, and sometimes the accrual doesn't seem just. But that doesn't mean that that's not the law. And the Supreme Court rejected the argument in that case that how could they possibly know? They're not lawyers. They're relying on their lawyer to tell them. I mean, these people, that's why they have a lawyer, to advise them. And the Supreme Court said, yes, however, this is when it accrues.
So in Sanchez, even if he had not known that the appeal was not taken, you're saying the result would have been the same under the reasoning of Sanchez?
Yes. And this court's cases following Sanchez have implemented that same rule. And in this case in particular, there's no reason to depart from that because he entered the plea and the ineffective assistance would have occurred on the same day. So we're not talking about something happening after the fact that he that delayed filing or made it so that he couldn't file. Everything happened on the same day when he entered that plea in 2012 or 2013. And this petition was not filed until 2019, almost 6 years later.
Mr. Zettler, how do you respond to the point when I asked Ms. Miller of the distinction that objectively, however, what is new is the Eighth Circuit interpretation of this particular offense he was pleading guilty to is an unequivocal on an automatic deportation. That clearly would not have been in the attorney's knowledge, his knowledge, or anyone's knowledge at the time. So objectively, even if we presume, which we do based perhaps on the sentence in the plea petition at a minimum, that at least a general Padilla information was provided, no attorney could have told him about what was learned in 2018 as a result of that Eighth Circuit.
Without having seen the Eighth Circuit ruling, that's correct. So I would agree with you.
So you would agree that would be a distinction, at least from our earlier unpublished cases, which otherwise had similar factual scenarios and applying the Sanchez two-step, as you just identified, denied relief.
So if this court were to find an Eighth Circuit opinion from 2018 somehow impacted Minnesota's analysis, then obviously there's been cases from this court after 2018, which would be presumably they would have been aware of this opinion. This opinion was never presented to the district court, so how could the district court have abused its discretion in making a ruling on this on an issue that was never presented? And the question would then be perhaps would that be retroactive? And since Padilla itself is not retroactive, that seems highly unlikely. As far as an evidentiary hearing, the district court, because it did not hold an evidentiary hearing, simply assumed the facts to be as alleged. And that's the order that the district court made in the findings of fact. And there is the letter from the defense attorney where he doesn't recall what he talked about, but there is also then the defendant talking about what he was told and what he remembered. And yes, he did have the plea petition read to him and he had no questions about it. And this defendant in particular is not new to the system. This isn't his first offense. He has prior felony convictions. So they didn't get into that because there was not an evidentiary hearing and there didn't need to be an evidentiary hearing because even taking what they've alleged as true, the claim is still accrued and barred by the 2-year statute of limitations. Unless the court has any other questions, I would simply ask this court to affirm the post-conviction court.
It appears we have none. Thank you. Ms. Miller, do you wish to use your rebuttal time?
Just one, a couple. The point that I would, I guess, just make is that I do think that the facts in Sanchez were different. In Sanchez, it was an issue of the appeal not being filed, as Your Honor said, and he knew at that time that the appeal was not filed, and he could have done something about
it. Well, instead of doing something about it, he left for Mexico for more than 2 years.
So he didn't take any action. So, and I do disagree with the way that those facts are applied to the cases dealing with immigration law, because, again, in these cases, as is in my client's case, at the time of his plea, he thought nothing of it. Whether that's my client's, and perhaps that could be attributed to my client, but again, that's why you hire a lawyer. You hire a lawyer to be able to tell you what the law is, to be able to tell you what you need to be careful about, to be able to tell you the consequences. Padilla very clearly found that that is an issue that would merit ineffective assistance of counsel if someone is not informed of the immigration consequences. And as a result of that, my client is facing being deported from the United States. The counsel raises the issue of the fact that my client has another a record outside of this. We're not disputing that, but this was the only offense that landed him in immigration proceedings. And so just the fact that he's had interaction with the system before doesn't mean that he wasn't perhaps provided ineffective assistance of counsel before. We don't know what happened in those cases. We're not saying we know what happens in those cases. We're saying that this case landed him in deportation. The other ones didn't. He never had contact with immigration until after he pled guilty to this offense. And the reason that he's in deportation is due to this offense. In saying that the ineffective assistance of counsel occurred on the same day is tough for me to wrap my mind around, because and that my client knew about it on that same day is tough for me to wrap my mind around. What is the point of ineffective assistance of counsel if it could all happen on that day? How does anyone ever bring a claim that they were ill-advised or improperly informed if they don't know about that improper advice, or they don't know that they were improperly informed until outside of the 2 years? That just seems like a very large injustice. No one would ever have any recourse if that were the case.
Looking at page 4 of the plea transcript, he was asked, Mr. Mao was asked by Mr. Ford, I'm showing you a petition to enter a guilty plea. It's several pages. You and I went through this document, and he says correct.
And I don't dispute that.
So he seems to have at least had that much correct information from having looked at the plea document.
Correct, yes. And would just, again, the way I looked at that is that it would bolster my argument that he improperly advised him. Because again, if it's the attorney's duty to make sure that they're going through the plea petition, that the defendant understands everything in that plea petition, and again, and Padilla said that this was an issue that they need to be told about. They need to be told if there's going to be an issue. My client says he was never told. That if they're going through a plea petition and they, if you're going through a plea petition with a client and you have no reason to believe that they are not a citizen or that they are an immigrant, on the flip side of that, you may not tell them that there could be immigration consequences. You may not tell them what those immigration consequences are because you don't know that they're not a citizen. My client says he was never asked if he was a permanent resident. One can assume that that was perhaps because there was no factual reasons that the attorney felt to ask him that, because he's been here for so long and he seemed as though he was a citizen. Again, he had a record, so I suppose maybe that attorney just thought that there was no issues that needed to be addressed.
I think the question is, and it's a difficult one, is attorneys can give ineffective assistance in myriad ways, including what you just described, and a defendant may not understand that until some point in time in the future, you know, the failure to investigate someone or, you know, whatever it might be. The question is, what do we do, and how does that limitations period, which also seems unfair, but also has some finality to convictions. You know, what there's right. that tension there, and I don't know. The question is that different from Sanchez or the other cases that, you know, sort of favor the finality, I guess, over what one might look at as how is this fair to the individual?
Well, and I would say that
you can finish answering.
That should run when the person finds out. So in Sanchez, he found out. He knew at that hearing the appeal wasn't filed. And as Your Honor said, he then took the decision to leave to Mexico and filed 3 years after finding out about the potential ineffective assistance of counsel. In this case, my client did file within the 2 years of finding out. And so I agree that there is... that things do need to be final. They cannot just keep going forever and ever. But that's where the two-year reasonableness exception in the statute comes in. And he filed within 2 years of reasonably knowing and learning of the immigration consequences when he was informed by an immigration judge and took direct steps to talk to an immigration attorney after that point.
Looks like there are no additional questions. Now, I want to revisit the subject of this supplemental authorities. Mr. Zettler, would you be... amenable if I were to have appellant's counsel supply both you and the court with whatever supplemental authorities by Monday, and that no additional argument, just cases. You have till Wednesday to supply any cases that you think might shed additional light on whatever light she sheds.
Sure, yes.
All right. So the record will be held open until Wednesday, February 26th. By the close of business on the 24th, Ms. Miller, you'll give Mr. Zettler and the court whatever supplemental authorities limited to this Eighth Circuit subject.
Yes.
Not just a free-ranging bunch of cases, but on this particular topic. By the close of business Monday, and Mr. Zettler, you can do the same by the close of business Wednesday, the 26th. The matter will then be submitted, and we'll issue our decision within 90 days of that date. Thank counsel for your briefing and argument. Interesting issue. Thank you for being here early, Mr. Zettler. And Ms. Miller, you came here promptly upon discovery of the problem, so we appreciate that as well.
I apologize.
That's the end of our calendar for today. Thank you. We're adjourned.